You're listening to the AHDB podcast, practical know-how to help your farm business. Hello, and welcome to this Cereals and Oilseeds episode of the AHDB podcast. I'm Emily Pope, Senior Knowledge Transfer Manager at AHDB. It's Strategic Farm Week, and in this special edition of the podcast, we'll discuss the research taking place at our host farms across the UK. This includes research on maximising the value of marginal land, monitoring and nurturing beneficial insects, soil cultivations, and reducing fungicides in wheat. Our strategic cereal farm host for the East, Brian Barker, will chair a discussion panel featuring the researchers overseeing the trials for the Harvest 2021 season.
And welcome to the AHDB Cereals and Oilseeds podcast. I'm Brian Barker, arable farmer from Suffolk and the host of the AHDB Strategic Farm for the East. We've got some great characters on screen who are going to be talking through our podcast today, and I'm going to bring them in a minute. But the idea of this is to sort of bring a bit of the Strategic Farm Week alive about what's going on the farms, looking at the research that's been carried out here in the East, but also in the West and up north in Scotland. So we've got some great topics to discuss and talk about. I've been involved with the Strategic Farm from the start. I was the first in the country. So I've been given the gig of talking this through with everyone. This is my first time hosting a podcast. So I'm sure there'll be a few tongue-tied moments, but I'm sure it will come across on this talk. So I'm going to introduce my panel of experts, and I'm going to ask them to do a brief introduction of themselves, and then we can start getting to the nitty-gritty of talking farming. So firstly, I'd like to go to Emily.
Hi, my name's Emily Pope, and I'm a Senior Knowledge Transfer Manager within the AHDB Cereals and Oilseeds Knowledge Exchange team. I've been at AHDB for just over 5 years, working primarily between our research and knowledge exchange programmes. A lot of my work involves providing that technical input into both of those programmes and sharing the output of research projects on farm.
Brilliant. Thank you, Emily. David, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is David Clark. I work in the Soils and Farming Systems Research at NIAB TAG, but I'm also doing a centre-funded PhD at Cranfield looking at the drivers of crop productivity and the spatial and temporal variation that's driving that and how we can best manage that on farm.
Brilliant. Thank you, David. And Kate?
Hi, I'm Kate Smith. I'm a soil scientist with ADAS, and been working with ADAS for the last 10 years now. And as part of that, been working on the Strategic Farm East and Strategic Farm West. And more recently, my research has included investigating the impacts of cover crops on soil structure, water quality, and crop yields.
Brilliant. Thank you, Kate. And I'll introduce Lorna.
Hi, I'm Lorna Cole from Scotland's Rural College, and I'm an agricultural ecologist. And I'll be focusing on looking at all the insects, the good, the bad, and the ugly at the strategic farm in Scotland.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And Fiona, finally.
So I'm Fiona Burnett, and I'm an applied plant pathologist at Scotland's Rural College, and I also head their knowledge exchange and impact programme. So knowledge exchange is a key piece of my role, and I chair the Fungicide Resistance Action Group UK, which really links nicely to my own research interests, which are around fungicide efficacy, resistance, and how we can better integrate and use sustainable methods.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, welcome everyone. Obviously, with the pandemic, which is going on at the moment, which means that Strategic Farm Week has gone digital, hence the podcast. We miss out on that farmer-to-farmer sort of learning, the discussion with researchers, with scientists who come to these sort of events. And part of those days is great when farmers get together and they discuss what's going on in the industry and how they can change their mindset with everything that they're trying to do on their own farms at home, and then sort of gleaming information out of the minds that turn up. And obviously the industry is changing in very fast and dynamic ways at the moment. The agricultural bill has just been signed. We've got the 25-year environment plan, which is all set in stone. So this is what the agricultural industries have to sort of look at going forward, and how are we going to meet those demands that the government has put into papers for us to sort of work out what we're going to do. We know that the area payment of the basic payment system is being phased out. So we're moving away from the payment by every acre or hectare that you actually grow crops on. And we're moving more into the environmental delivering public goods. And this could be for water quality, for fresh air, could be for all manner of different things. And this is all going to be, hopefully, once a little bit more detail gets more meat on the bones, really. And so we've got to look at a more sympathetic and how we've got to deliver the same amount of output by applying less and being much more aware of our impact on the wider environment, looking at the landscape in a whole. And this is what my role as the strategic farmer is, to look at my whole farming system, bringing in different ideas, looking at what's happening on the ground on a wide scale, not looking at the small plot and trials that many people see around the country, but looking at it on a much more field scale. And so this is where the strategic farm is completely different to many other things, because it's looking at that wide scale, long-term approach. It's a six-year project for the host farm. So I'm in start of year four. So we've done a lot, and we've got a lot to talk about to moving forward. So I'm just going to bring in Emily, who's just going to sort of set the picture about where the research is and why it's important to bring research onto farms at all levels that the AHDB do.
Yeah, I think, you know, we all appreciate that research is really important, and that actually research can be conducted at multiple scales, and there's a need for that to happen at the different scales. What the strategic farms do is actually just bring some variety and bring a different element to the way in which we conduct research. So taking it from, as you said, the plot replicated small scales and taking it out onto farm. I think it's going to be really important, actually. You know, we've already highlighted some of the challenges and the opportunities with some of the future policies, but it's going to be really important that farmers and agronomists are able to apply that new research on farm, not only to try new approaches that are tailored to their specific challenges, opportunities and landscape, but also to build capacity within the industry in terms of trialing on farm. So the ability to design on-farm trials, to ask the right questions, to collect the correct information in the most appropriate way, and to actually use that information to make better decisions.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's about changing mindset. And I think farmers now have to ask a lot more questions. They've got to have a different approach. They've got to go out and actually learn new things. Like we're going to be talking about integrated pest management. We need to know what the beneficial insects look like and what they do and where they live. So the role of the farmer has changed, that he has to be much more aware of everything going on. And There's lots of things that sort of the AHDB do, and I know I've been involved with the Monitor Farm Programme. And do you just want to mention the Monitor Farm Programme and then where it fits in with the strategic farm?
Yeah, it's a really important part of what we do at AHDB. And as you said, we've got the network of strategic farms. They're very much looking at that application of research on farm. And it's really important that we can then share and communicate what we're learning at the strategic farms across the industry network, and that includes the monitor farms. So those monitor farms are very much business driven and business focused, looking at that whole farm business and how they can make improvements and changes in the short, medium and long term. And you've talked about the changing nature or the changing role of the farmer in this landscape. And I think it's probably safe to say that that's only going to change increasingly over the next few years. And as part of that is the ability to collect data to demonstrate the changes that those farmers are making and the benefits and the impacts of those changes.
Yeah, exactly. And I know that from the diversity of people we've had turn up to the events that host before the pandemic, that there was a great range of farmers, advisors, agronomists. And it's great that there's so many people coming together for the strategic farm events. And then obviously, hopefully that many people listening have been logging into the webinars that we've had for the results day this during this week. And hopefully it's been some really good stuff come out of it. So I'm going to start moving things on. One thing that I've done on my farm is sort of look at the actual full landscape of the farm. And we all know that in the old days of the area payment, you're trying to farm everything as wide as possible, as far as possible, so you're getting your maximum sort of income from the subsidies. But as we know that the subsidies is now going to be phased out, we've got to start looking at our farm in a completely different way. And we've done a couple of exercises with my farm, personally, looking at parts of the farm that don't really deliver the full yields, the maximum income. And this is something that I think is going to be really key for many farms across the country, that we've got to start looking at our farm in a completely different way. So I'm going to bring David in with this work that he's been doing with us about how to identify parts of the farms that may not work as much in efficiencies as us, and how he's doing it and what he's sort of bringing to the party, really.
Thanks, Brian. So obviously with the Environment Land Management Scheme coming in, farmers are likely going to be required to take some land out of production and put these into schemes, whatever these schemes may look like in detail. So informed decisions on what land should be taken out and what schemes should be put there is going to need to be made. And spatial data sets such as yield maps, as you mentioned, Brian, are going to be important to this. And many farms have been collecting spatial data, whether it's yield maps, for some instances, which is the case on your farm, Brian, for the last 10 years and even further. But there's also a lot of spatial data that's being collected by people, and I use the term people loosely, that we don't even realise. For example, Google Earth has got high-res images of farms going back to 1940s in some places. The Environment Agency, have been running the National LiDAR programme, so we've basically got 1 metre resolution elevation data across most of the UK. Sorry, England. And then obviously agronomy companies will offer in-season NDVI images from commercial satellites. Chances are you're not very far from a weather station. AHDB weather hub's a good example of this. And then obviously farmers can pay for data, whether it's soil scans, nutrient mapping, and so on. So we've become very good at measuring things, not quite as good at using these measurements for informed decision. And this has always been a challenge for us as scientists, agronomists, and farmers. So we're planning to look at this data across the rotation, including the yield maps and the variable costs, to calculate margins on a spatial scale, so on a gridded scale across the farm. This will allow us to sort of form a picture of farm profitability across the years, across the different crops, and then across the rotation as a whole, allowing us to identify areas of marginal land where profitability and productivity is reduced. So we're planning to look at this data across the rotation, including variable crops, to calculate margins and produce a marginal map of the farm.
So basically, we're really coming down to identifying the best bits and the worst bits.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have an informed discussion with everyone involved within the farm, the agronomist, the history, the landowner or the farm manager. And then you can start saying, well, is this because X, Y, and Z? Is it drainage or is it just soil? Is it shading? Is it pests? Is it rabbits? So there's plenty of things you can do, isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. So this marginal land map can be used in conjunction with other spatial data, erosion runoff risk maps, which I believe you've already had done by the Norfolk Rivers Trust, Brian. And then that'll allow us to include recommendations of where on farm and when in the rotation different elm schemes might be best utilised. So for examples, these might be annual schemes such as pollinator strips, wild bird feed areas. These areas are likely to be flexible depending on the crop and the species. So for example, the area of land classified as marginal for spring beans might be different for something, say, winter wheat. There's also likely to be areas of marginal land that are least productive across the rotation as a whole. And therefore, these will be likely areas most suitable to be taken out for longer periods of time, potentially on a larger scale, tier two and three schemes.
Yeah, and I think that's where, obviously, with the stuff that we've been doing at home, we've obviously looked at this. We always say straight line farming, trying to avoid farming triangles, because triangles, you either over apply or you under apply. And so there's quite a lot that we sort of can draw from that and put in schemes. And I think from our experience of higher level stewardship now in higher tier, we've only taken 5% of our real, what we class as our marginal land, but it's going to be really fascinating to see what you sort of bring in with when you start combining all these data sets. I do it just by eye and what I see on the ground, but it's going to be fantastic to see this all merged into many different layers, and that's the sort of thing that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. And one thing, we can take it a step further as well and also look at what's driving these areas, this so-called marginal land. Why is it marginal? Is it management decisions that can be potentially altered, or is it just underlying soil type that we can do nothing about? So this will allow us to make management decisions across the rotation. We might identify a field that potentially it could benefit from more organic matter amendments, therefore, you know, increasing soil carbon, but then also the agricultural productivity to you as a farmer. So yeah. I think there's a nice look of both from the environmental side, you know, we can identify where we can probably take land out, but then also from a farming point of view, we can identify areas that actually might need a bit of attention or a change of management, rotation, whatever that be.
Yeah, exactly. And it's we've always been told when you go to sort of farming events, data is going to be the next thing that farmers need to be sort of utilising, and technology. And this is a great example of how technology and all these satellite imagery is going to be drawn into it so that farmers can make much more educated sort of decisions the way through. So thank you, David. That's really interesting about what you're doing. But once we've identified these marginal bits around the farm, I've got wildflower margins, I've got pollen and nectar corners, I've got wild seed mixes, I've got grass margins for buffering water courses. But these areas, we can't really forget about them, and we've got to really understand what their worth to the farming system and landscape is. So I'm going to bring in Lorna here, because she's going to be sort of hopefully going to shed some light on the real benefits that these extra bits around the edge can deliver when we're talking about integrated pest management, which is a real buzzword that's going around the industry at the moment, and it has done for a few years, but I think it's really starting to speed up, and the snowball effect of IPM and integrated pest management is really taking speed. So Lorna, would you like to sort of give your sort of take on what's been going on the strategic farms and your work that you're doing there?
So my work will focus on the strategic farm in Scotland, and what we're trying to get to grips with is the balance between the beneficial insects and the pest species. So for this work, we'll focus on three key groups of beneficial insects that play slightly different roles. So we'll look at ground active predators such as wolf spiders and ground beetles. And these predators are important for controlling pests that are active on the ground, such as slugs. We'll also look at the natural enemies within the crop canopy. So species such as ladybirds, hoverfly larvae, parasitic wasps, and they are important for controlling pests in the canopy, such as aphids. And finally, we are not going to forget our insect pollinators. The value of these pollinators to agriculture is becoming increasingly acknowledged. So we're going to look at bumblebees, hoverflies, solitary bees.
Yeah, so it's amazing there's so many insects out there. And my eyes have been opened. We call it wildlife auditing on our farm, because that's what basically we start out doing with anything like the trials that we've done through the strategic farm. We always set a looking at a baseline. So can you explain how you would set your baseline on your farm, and what sort of traps and things that you're using to sort of identify these sort of insects?
So we'll use different traps depending on the groups. So for our ground active insects, our beetles, our ground beetles and spiders, we'll use pitfall traps. I mean, ecologists were quite Blue Peter. So a pitfall trap is just a yogurt pot that we put in the ground at ground level, and the insects scurry along the ground and fall into them. We'll also be using water traps, so just basically buckets of water with some detergent in it to break the surface tension. And these will be placed below the crop canopy to catch species such as our ladybirds, our hoverfly larvae. And for the pollinators, we are hoping to use solitary bee trap nests, so little tubes that the solitary bees will crawl into, and they lay their eggs in it. The eggs develop into larvae, and we can count the larvae and the pupae that are there and determine an idea of the population density.
Yeah, so it's not weird and wacky science equipment. It's actually just getting down on hands and knees, digging a few holes. And this comes down to what we're trying to sort of get farmers to do more of. And part of the strategic farm sort of AHDB role was sort of produce some how-to guides. And all the way through this week with strategic farm, and then the past weeks that we've had for other things, we've done some how-to guides, how to do vest scores, how to do some simple ground beetle auditing. There's great publications, and I can direct you to the AHDB library of publications, because the Encyclopedia of Pests and Beneficials is in there somewhere. I think that's what it's called. There's a big Bible of things. So if anyone wants to sort of know more and get pictures and IDs and things like that, there's a great place to go to. But one thing in the press a lot, Lorna, is the actual decline of insects. And this is obviously touted around, and a lot of basins and farmers sort of feel like we've been bashed from side to side. But can you just sort of give your take on the decline, and do farmers have a role that we can sort of really benefit long term? So I'd just be interested to know what your thoughts are.
I think the decline is concerning. Beneficial insects, they all play slightly different roles and they interact with each other. So a healthy ecosystem will support a wide range of insects, and this diversity, it increases benefits that are provided. So for example, if we have a diverse pollinator community, we have more effective pollination services, and this can impact yield and insect pollinated crops. But I think more importantly than this is the fact that diversity acts like an insurance policy. So if we have a bunch of insects, it helps make sure that in times of change or times of disruption, pollination or pest control is maintained. So as one species struggles and populations decline, the other species can step in and pick up the slack.
Yeah, exactly. And knowing your thresholds and your populations and your species is key. And I know that my cousin Patrick does a lot of wildlife auditing on our farm, and we've built up a really lovely picture of what is sort of benefiting with these areas that we've classed as marginal land and putting them back to wildlife. And it's a really fascinating journey to get on. And I would say to any farmer, get involved with sort of finding out what you've got on your farm, the big farm and bird counts, just doing basically keeping a wildlife diary, and just seeing what you see when you see it. And you'll see there's lots of little things that you sort of draw upon year on year. And it's a really fascinating thing. But thank you very much for that, Lorna.
There's a wealth of information and resources for your business on the AHDB Knowledge Library. Visit ahdb.org.uk.
But so that sort of brings us nicely into the way that we've identified parts of our farm that may not be the most efficient parts that we can use with the environmental side. And we can see that hopefully from the trials that the strategic farm are doing, that these areas of marginal land can then benefit the cropped area. But the actual cropped area, we can't forget the actual areas that we actually are doing very well. And soil is something that is the key part of all growing mediums, that we want to sort of benefit and look after it in the best way we possibly can. And when we start talking about thresholds of beneficials and pests and thresholds of earthworms, is something that we can sort of do with a lot of soil testing, digging holes. How many earthworms per spadeful might be the metric that many farmers are going to brag about instead of having pub yields in a few years. And I know that I set the stall quite high, that I've actually had dug a hole in one of my fields doing a soil test, and I had a witness, and we actually counted 70 worms in a spadeful. So I've set the bar quite high, and I reckon that they all migrated to one spot because ADAS came out and did the actual repeat baselining. That was one of the fields which had the least number of worms. worms in it. So it is all very hit and miss. But I'd like to bring Kate in because she's been working here at the East and at the West, doing some really interesting stuff with cover crops and with lots of different things over at the West. And I know I've been keeping tabs on what's going on at the West with the cultivation strategies and things like that. So, Kate, could you just sort of give us a sort of overview of what you've been doing with us in the East and in the West with a strategic farm?
Yes. Okay. So at Strategic Farm West, we've had a cultivations trial, which started in harvest year 2019. So this year it's going into its third year of the trial, and should continue hopefully for the end of the Strategic Farm. So we'll be running for 6 years in total. And the trial is going to be looking at the impacts of different cultivation systems on soil health, on crop rooting and crop yields. We've been able to set up a replicated tramline trial, so we're able to take account of the variability across the field site. And we have four different treatments there. We have a direct drill, a shallow cultivation depth to about 5 centimetres, which is done with springtime, 15 centimetres cultivation depth, which is done with a disc aerator, and 30 centimetres cultivation depth, again, done with a disc aerator. And the assessments that we're carrying out on Rob's farm include, you know, what the impacts on soil structure. So we can do that through doing visual evaluation of soil structure. So the VAERS assessments, penetrometer, bulk density. And as Brian mentioned, we're measuring earthworm populations, but also impacts on crop routine and yields. This is carried out across the whole field. And obviously it's quite, you know, as we said, it's variability across the field. So we've tried to account for that variability by carrying out the assessments on a zonal basis. So we first characterise sites by taking penetrometer meetings and figuring out the areas that have got max, medium and minimum areas of compaction. So over time, we can see how, you know, the cultivation is impacting on the soil. And, you know, this year, the site went into spring beans. That was after a really challenging autumn, winter and spring. Rob tried to get some oilseed rape to establish, but it's really poor establishment, very wet soils, and cabbage stem flea beetle damage just meant that, yeah, the crop had to be abandoned and it went into winter beans. It's an interesting site. It's a heavy soil. And in the first year, when we carried out some first assessments, so coming out with scores of freeze and falls, so we've seen a level of compaction there. And there were very few earthworms on the site. Yeah, so as we continue this reduction in cultivation over the next few years, it'll be interesting to see what is the impact on soil structure and earthworm numbers. And obviously last year was a particularly challenging year
I'm sitting here nodding because I found it quite difficult, and we've had a bit of fun games in the East this year as well, and there's a few people still struggling, but it's been a struggle. So I did feel for Rob when he was trying to do a cultivation trial in what were the wettest autumns. So is there any indications of sort of early results that you can sort of enlighten us on?
Well, this last year we saw that the highest crop yields were coming where there was the deeper cultivation. And actually where the shallower cultivation was taking place, there was a half ton reduction in yields. But overall, if you look at sort of across the gross margins, they were breaking even, given that, you know, the direct drilling will have less cost of establishment. I mean, this is not unusual to see in the first few years of going towards a reduced tillage. You can see a reduction in yields, but maybe over time, what we want to see is that as the soil start restructuring, as you get more, hopefully get more earthworm activity, you know, will we pick up some more differences in soil structure and some improvement in crop rooting, really, with that reduced tillage. So it's a wait and see. really.
Yeah, having started the journey of trying to reduce cultivations and doing less, people do say that there's a drop off of yield. And I would say that that is possible on certain soil types. But I found the biggest drop off of yield is actually because you take the safety blanket of cultivations away. And so it then becomes the decision on the fly from the farmer has a bigger impact. And I know certainly the where I've got it wrong, it's been difficult to talk to my dad and my uncle about what's going on in that field. And so the drop off of yield might actually be more because of the decisions that you've made rather than the actual soils. And I would say, and I know that you've been working here in the East about cover crops, and we've done some great work looking at plow versus direct drilling cover crops with nitrate. And I've been jumping in the bottom of ditches and taking water samples, and we've seen some fascinating information about the amount of nitrate that is being absorbed by cover crops compared to an overwinter plough. And when you compare that the EU water directive is 50 milligrams per litre, a cover crop is sort of absorbing so much, it's only releasing sort of 5 milligrams out of the drain outlets. And then when you compare that to an overwinter plough that's sort of 250 plus, it is staggering. And this is where cover crops are. I go back and forth about the good and the bad, but short term, it's about getting the best out of your crop. And sometimes cover crops actually add more risk. And then if you look at the other hat of environmental for elms, for public money, for public good, water quality, air quality, biodiversity, there's massive tick points. And I know we had some sort of 2-ton reductions in our spring barley this year, which you sort of highlighted to me in the results meeting, which sort of wasn't great. But is there anything you just want to add about cover crops?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just summarised it all lovely there, Brian. I mean, they can have these great benefits in terms of what we're calling public goods, in terms of water quality, and it's a source of organic matter going back to the soil. But there is this question about how it impacts on crop yields and farm profitability, and hopefully this gap or this uncertainty will be recognised by schemes such as ELM, so that some of those costs that farmers are going to incur as a result of cover cropping can be covered, and hopefully that will help to incentivise their use, really. Yeah. But also with the cover cropping, I mean, there's other things that we're not quite sure on, or haven't got all the evidence for, say, for the impact on the pests and beneficial insects, really. And some of the work that would be continuing on the strategic farm should help continue up and follow them and answer those questions. And again, it's provided those evidence base. What is the impact of these management practices on the range of public goods, and what are the trade-offs?
Exactly. Yeah. And it dovetails great into our sort of final snippet, which is bringing Fiona in. And we've got, obviously, looking at soil, we've got our crops growing, and we've now got a crop growing. This is something that I challenge myself with work done with the strategic farm, of how we can become much more aware of our responsibility sort of in growing these crops. So, Fiona, do you want to sort of discuss the work that you're doing in Scotland with reducing sort of inputs?
Yes, so there's so many ways to start reducing inputs in a really sensible way. And you've given a great lead in that idea. There's, you can't start planning too early. So the whole thing around, is it the right crop? Do you need to crop the rotations? But then recognising your risks. So we know when it comes to IPM methods, farmers value the preventative measures the most. And sometimes I think we don't get enough credit for that. So just recognising your main risks and preventing them up front is really key. Obviously, we've talked about drilling date today, and that's particularly contentious this year. But however you cut the drilling, you're going to end up with crops that are earlier drilled than others that you can then treat differently. And you can recognise other things. If you know that your main disease risks are, for example, septoria, then you can select resistant varieties. And again, we know that's a tool that we're all really comfortable with. you've talked about mindset change, Brian, but that's really key. So that idea that we have fewer generic programs and we start to tailor what we're doing to the risks. You obviously at the strategic firm East are interested in reducing the inputs at the key timings in wheat. You're looking at T1, 2 and 3. But again, there are just really simple ways to start reducing what we're doing, which are really low risk. So, I mean, I would always start with just getting the most out of the chemistry that you are using. So you use the optimum timings, you use the best available chemistry, you think about resistance management, and these are easy win-wins. And then you can start to build the complexity up and you start to think of, you know, can we start to take out timings? So there are decisions about T-naughts if you're at risk of yellow rust. Perhaps if you're on light land that burns off early, low risk of ear diseases, you can take down your late sprays. You've got that you can reduce dose, you can take out actives. And again, I always like to think resistance management wise, the more complex the chemistry you can use, the better from a resistance management point of view. So actually, if you can get to the same end result with lower doses of more actives, that's just a better way to get the efficacy that you need. And these are just really simple ways before you then start tailoring what you're doing. And Emily referred earlier to the links between, you know, small plot trials and the start of trials that we're starting to do on farms. So I've been involved in a 5-year program with AHGB looking at tailoring inputs, fungicide inputs to different varieties, where just to take a few examples, if you look at a resistant wheat variety, on a late drilled site, actually the benefits of high inputs are really hardly there at all. But conversely, you're very susceptible varieties. So maybe something like Elation drilled early, you get massive responses to your fungicide programs. So it's really just self-evident that one size will never fit all, and we can be much, much smarter before we even get into the really complex, you know, data and monitoring and the extra intelligence we can bring. There's loads we can do.
Yeah, and I would sort of advocate that. Obviously, the recommended lists of the AHDB is a great resource, and split up and you start looking at that, analysing it. And I think, certainly I've been much more mindful of growing varieties which we're aiming for certain markets and how they actually get positioned in our rotation, looking at sort of the more robust all-rounders like the Grahams and the Siskins who have a good disease package. We can then sort of look at them in a slightly different way when it comes to low disease years, that we might be able to rein them back. But then one thing that I always keep coming back to in my head, and my dad always tells me, is don't farm for the last year. And that is something that many farms are probably going to be stuck in that mindset of, oh, it was a low disease year last year, we won't need to do it. All the research has said that if you didn't put much on, we'll get a sensible return. But be very mindful. And it's great to hear you talking about risk management. And that's what farmers are basically doing. We're just managing risk all the way through the season of trying to farm a factory with no roof. It's really interesting work, and I know there's some exciting stuff going on in Scotland. I got lucky enough to go up there and see what was going on in the research community in Scotland, and it's fascinating. I know I'm looking at my watch and seeing the time is sort of drawing to an end. So I'd just like to thank all our sort of guests for their insights into what's been going on at the strategic farms across the country. And I'm going to bring back Emily because it's not all stop here. Work is continuing afoot. I've been out jumping in the bottom of ditches for you, catching drain samples. I've walked the flowering margins, and I've seen there's a few things on flower. We've got some yarrow and some oxized daisies still giving some late pollinating food. There's lots going on. So, Emily, do you just want to just give a quick recap of what's going to go on, what state of play we are in the East and where we are in the West and where we are in the strategic farm for Scotland?
Yeah, so there's lots of work that's coming up over the next year. We've already heard around, you know, the trials looking at fungicides and varieties. So we've got trials at both the strategic cereal farm East and West looking at a range of different varieties under different input strategies. So that will continue. Kate's told us about the cultivations work at the strategic farm in the West, and that will continue for the full duration of the programme. obviously David shared his work on the marginal land, and Lorna's provided a great insight into the pest and natural enemy work. So there's an amazing amount of work that's going on. And obviously, I think we probably all agree that the strategic farms get better year on year. We're constantly listening to the industry feedback, and we're always reviewing what we're doing. So we're always really keen to hear any thoughts and ideas from the industry in terms of what they'd like to see on their strategic farms, essentially. But you're right, it doesn't stop here. After the amazing strategic cereal farm week that we've just had, it's really important that people keep up to date with all of our events, all of the results that we'll be sharing throughout the season. Obviously, creating lots of videos in this digital age and downloads that are available for everybody to access.
Brilliant. Well, I'd certainly sort of echo everything there is that Emily just said. There's loads going on, and I speak for myself, Rob and David, and say thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to host these fantastic scientific minds coming onto our farm, and its way of engaging with the research community. It's a fantastic opportunity for farmers to get involved, and I'm sure there'll be sort of more opportunities for farmers to get involved all the way along. And if it's sort of ignited a burning passion to get involved, then please get in touch with the AHDB team and register your interest. So it's been a fascinating sort of overview of what's going on across the country. Really comes back to a landscape approach for myself. We've got to look at the marginal land slightly differently. We can't just keep slogging away trying to get the final extra little bits of tons out of the bits that are costing us more to produce than we're actually going to sell it for. So these marginal land, we can use them differently. We can really sort of enhance our landscape and our biodiversity through the environmental stewardship, and then potentially the land management, the environmental land management schemes that are hopefully going to get rolled out in the next few years. So I'd urge farmers to sort of start learning it, start auditing what they've got on their farm, look after their soil even more, sort of embrace the sort of different approaches of sort of trying to do less but maintain production, trying to use less insecticides, using less fungicides where possible, but don't miss the goal of that we are agricultural businesses and we need to make money at the end of the day. And I would like to thank AHDB for all their work that they're doing, supporting us farmers as we go into a very sort of nervy time of change, but also it's an exciting opportunity for us all to grasp, and the challenges will be with us. So thank you very much for joining us for this podcast. Thank you all the speakers who have joined us and given their insights into the work they're doing across the platforms of the Strategic Farm. So enjoy Strategic Farm Week. There's a few webinars left. Get involved. If you missed any, go back onto the YouTube channel and watch them through, because there is some great stuff out there. So thank you very much. I'm Brian Barker, signing out on the Strategic Farm podcast.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, why not leave a review to help other people find the show? It will really help us appear in the podcast rankings and mean we can reach more people.
A big thank you to Brian, David, Lorna, Kate, and Fiona for taking part in this month's podcast. All the information about Strategic Farm Week is available via the AHDB website by visiting ahdb.org.uk/SFweek-winter-2020. Don't worry if you've missed any webinars, you can watch recordings by visiting ahdb.org.uk/serials webinars. You can find results from all of this year's trials at ahdb.org.uk/SFweek-winter-2020/results. This includes reports from the strategic cereal farms in the East and West, free to download. You can also watch video content containing more information about each of the trials. To learn more about our three strategic cereal farms, you can visit their dedicated web pages. Links for each will appear in the show notes for this podcast. Don't forget to tune in today for the final day of Strategic Farm Week to watch videos on the trials in the ground for Harvest 2021, available from 8 a.m. At 9 a.m, be sure to tune in to our live Ask the Researcher session, where you can ask questions and talk with researchers behind the trials. I'm Emily Pope. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thanks for listening.